I just don't understand why he behaves the way he does with me. I'm not one nice thing. I've been trying all this time. He got coming here just gotta run his damn mouth.
I totally understand.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard, I know.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 264 for the week of August 19th, 2019. I am Upstairs Buffet David T. Cole, and I'm here with Full Immersion Cop Sarah D. Bunting.
Can we get a chlorine check on pool three?
Saved Satanist Tara Ariano.
Praise Satan. I mean him.
And Baptism Botcher Adam Sternberg.
I bless thee in the name of...
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us is our dear friend, Adam Sternberg. Adam. Hello, Adam.
Hello.
Adam.
Thank you for having me.
Two Adams back to back. What a world. We are here to talk about HBO's new sitcom, The Righteous Gemstones, the latest collaboration between Danny McBride and Jody Hill and David Gordon Green. Sometimes he directed some of the episodes. And I'll just briefly talk about the premise for those who didn't watch it. It's about a family of extremely wealthy South Carolina megachurch evangelists. Father Eli, played by John Goodman. Pastor sons Jesse and Kelvin, played by Danny McBride and Adam Devine. And bitter daughter Judy, played by Edie Patterson, I think. Eli had preached with his wife, Amy Lee, who as a child had a double act singing with her brother, but she has died and he is still actively mourning her and possibly also experiencing dementia symptoms, unclear. Early in the first episode, Jesse gets a blackmail threat over a video of himself and some of his prayer brothers partying with cocaine and sex workers in Atlanta. Jesse ends up involving his siblings in the cash drop, but he is an idiot and things go awry. So before we get into specifics, Adam, the hypocritical, money-grubbing Southern preacher is kind of a well-worn trope of comedy at this point. How did you feel The Righteous Gemstones took it in a new or surprising direction, if in fact you thought it did?
Well, I will say that at my advanced age, I no longer think of shows as being good or bad. I think of them as being for me or not for me.
Okay.
And this show was not for me. Partly because as I started watching the first episode, I was recalling, remember how Robin Williams used to always go on The Tonight Show and have those like frenetic appearances? And he'd always mix in this televangelist character that was like, yeah, yeah. And like the joke felt sort of tired in the 80s when Robin Williams was doing it. And I felt like this show never quite achieved escape velocity from that, from the basic joke of like televangelists are sort of ridiculous and they have ludicrous hair and they're hypocrites. All of which is true. And I will say that I watched of the episodes that were available, I watched the first four and I got more into the show as it went along. And there was little glimmers of hope for me. Like I quite like the Adam Devine character and I like the idea of lampooning that sort of hillside, more modern version of hipster Christianity.
Oh, Hillsong.
Hillsong, yes, that's right. I like the idea of sort of lampooning that. And if the show goes in that direction, I think there's an opportunity for it to open up. But I was a little disappointed with the first few episodes, how much they relied on exactly that standard trope of sort of you healed. And it never quite... It tickled me beyond that. And I should say, I'm not Danny McBride. I'm not like a huge Danny McBride fan to begin with. And I feel like he's kind of his own comedy genre at this point. So if you like Danny McBride, it probably will, you'll like the show a lot more than if you don't like Danny McBride.
Although I will say, I think like of the Danny McBride projects of the last decade, certainly on TV, this is the least Danny McBride-y. Like he at least... being one of the three main characters is not in your face on screen all the time, especially as the season progresses. And we're only going to talk about plot points of episode one here. We're not going to get into it, but just that know that the characters and where they go opens up quite a bit over the first six episodes.
I will say I was going to lead with my thing I liked about the show, which is that the cast is quite excellent, and John Goodman is great, and later in the the episodes Walton Goggins shows up, and I liked his character. So I don't know. I mean, is it possible that I'll circle back around and rejoin the show at some point? Maybe, but I was not really taken with it.
Sarah, based on what we were saying before we started recording, it sounds like this was not for you as well.
It is. And here's the thing. Danny McBride, like, keeps veering into my lane. Like, I am a Baptist baseball fan. Why don't I like this shit more? I don't. And I'm not sure. Adam's point about escape velocity is so well put. And when they come in on this, like, record setting baptism in China, and then the wave pool comes on, like, look, I was baptized via full immersion. That you do jockey for position to get the minister who's not gonna snap your head back, get much water up your nose. Like, this, there are things about this that are so dead on and lived in. Like, just the name John Wesley Seasons is like, if we could give like mini, like nano Emmys for things like that, I would give that one, because it's perfect. But there's just something about, like, first of all, the first episode, which is all I watched, individual scenes just seemed to go on too long. It just didn't feel, it felt a little self-indulgent, particularly for, you know, a premiere that is supposed to be trying to get a lot done. Like, it didn't feel piloty. It just felt a little slow. And I also kind of feel like, given where we are as a culture at the minute, I kind of wanted like a less comedic or like predictably comedic take on this family, something more like not considered, because I think this is really a considered story. I think they really sort of rolled around in it for a while doing their research, but just more, I don't know, like not trying so hard for the laugh and not being quite so in that Robin Williams, like, this is pretty low hanging fruit. And I just kind of wished that it would reach higher for some more of the conflict, but, and maybe it does that, but I won't be finding out, because Adam's other, you know, point, which is the axes of good and not good and for me and not for me, like, this just isn't for me. I don't know what it is about McBride product, but it just isn't quite, it doesn't quite finish the follow through, I guess, for me.
I kept expecting you to want to bail, because you're not a Danny McBride person either, but you seemed entertained by it.
Yeah, I think that Danny McBride, you know, he's one of those banana in your smoothie guys, you know, it's all you can taste if he's in it. I disagree, actually, with Adam and Sarah that, like, you know, the escape velocity factor, I kind of felt like they did a decent job, and maybe I'm colored by the perspective of having watched more than the pilot episode, but I thought they did a good job backgrounding the evangelizing aspect of it. Oh, I guess they're not tele, are they? Yeah, they are.
Well, they start out on television. It's not clear if they still are on TV, but they're definitely mega church people.
Right. As the show goes on and there are some Fargo-esque moments, you get a little glimpse of it at the end of the first episode. I feel like the taking advantage of the churchgoers aspect of it isn't really the main thrust of the show. Like, it does get into some character studies, although some of the characters are very one note, such as the sister who just, you know, craves dad's attention. And that is sort of her beat for the first season so far. But others, such as the main brothers and some of their lackeys, I find, like, has a very Fargo, what's the Lucky Logan sort of aspect to
Logan
it.
Logan Lucky, yeah.
Yeah. that I found quite entertaining. And I totally understand if somebody will bail because of the Danny McBride-iness of this. It is an acquired taste. I also don't have it. But I felt like, because he wasn't on screen all the time, like, you know, this is an ensemble show and a lot of people share screen time, that his character, very Danny McBridey, but wasn't on the screen so much that, you know, I wanted to bail on it. And that his main storyline in the first half of this first season, anyways, is like sort of the looniest one, helps a lot. You know, like that is where, when I make comparisons to Fargo, mostly the movie, you know, where dumb people do dumb things and things escalate. Like that's his storyline and it seems to fit and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I agree about Jesse. He's a little of him goes a long way and he definitely has the most heightened storyline. But I do think that they were trying with the rest of the characters, maybe less so Judy, but trying to make them seem like something other than cartoony cliches. Like Eli, for example, the father, the John Goodman character, is not a great person or minister or dad. But when the show portrays him in flashbacks with Amy Lee, which we see periodically, his wife, who has died, it does seem like they truly love each other. Like he respects her as his partner and as equal. And that was interesting to me that that was the way it's portrayed, because then the next generation women are definitely treated in a subservient way. So I'm curious to see like what has changed in that. And there's also an episode, episode 5 of this season, that's a huge departure and takes you way back in the family's history in a really interesting, compelling way that was like almost not comedic at all, which seems like that would be bad, but it really just deepens what you know about these characters in a fascinating way that I was not expecting. And I 100% agree about Walton Goggins. He is amazing as Baby Billy.
I kind of wish that the whole show was about him.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, I will say that after 2 episodes, I was pretty much out. And then, but I, because they're only half an hour, I watched the 3rd, and then that's when baby Billy shows up and I liked him. And then, the 4th episode focuses a lot more on Adam Devine's character. And my absolute favorite thing about the show was him and his ex-Satanist roommate / sidekick. Like that guy is amazing. And every time he was on the screen, I felt like the whole show just got 20% better. And I agree with Sarah. I mean, it is interesting to watch this show. And I remember when I saw the trailers for it on HBO thinking like, I hope this isn't going to feel like a parody of like Jimmy Swaggart and Jim Baker.
Yeah.
When it should be a parody of like Jerry Falwell Jr. and Joel Osteen and the people who mm-hmm. exist now in that world and who are sort of like interesting, complicated, sort of odious cultural figures, but in a different way than the like big-haired, holy roller stereotype. And maybe as it goes along, it'll get more into that. I mean, I also had just finished watching The Boys, and The Boys is not at all about this, obviously, but there's that one episode with Ezekiel, which is also sort of a Hillsong parody. And mm-hmm. I actually felt like their version of Hillsong sort of cut deeper and felt like a better satire of what that is than what they were doing with Adam Devine. And part of the problem, I guess, is that they have to sort of make Adam Devine's character sort of likable, and this sort of little episode that he has, he you can see them sort of treading the line between lampooning these characters, but also not making them so ridiculous that you just drop out of the show because they're so unlikable. Mm-hmm. And that's always the thing I found with Dan McBride in the past, is that you're sort of like, why am I watching this? Like, why do I want to spend time with these characters week after week after week? And I will say, to Dave's point, like this did feel the most compelling of the Danny McBride projects that I've watched on HBO. I never watched Vice Principals, but like when people used to tell me, and I know people are huge Eastbound and Down fans, and who would often say to me like, "Oh, you should watch the show; you would love it." But I would just never quite got what the fun of it was.
Yeah, it's sort of the same for me. Like I think he picks these characters that actually might be better served by not lampooning them. That the Righteous Gemstones seems like, and Nashville was far from a perfect show, but it had that potential of like, this is the stereotype, and now let's flip that over and look at how it's really knotted on the back of the tapestry. So if you're not going to do that, that is fine, and that is a choice, but then it needs to be much funnier than this. If that makes any sense. Like, it's kind of trying to have it both ways. And for me, not quite there. Like, I'm not angry that I spent an hour with this, like, idea and the people in it. But it's the same with Eastbound and Down, and always has been. Like, occasionally I'll watch an episode and be like, this needs to be either much more of one thing or much funnier, and it just isn't quite there. Like, Danny McBride himself is not annoying to me. It's just the projects that he's in, I tend to be like, it's trying to ride some line, and it doesn't work for me.
For me, Danny McBride characters are always like, which of the Odd Couple guys is the slob? Is that Felix or is it the other guy?
Oscar.
Oscar's the slob. So he's like Oscar, which is like kind of a lovable slob. But then like Danny McBride comes in, he's like, he also likes to look up skirts. And you're like, well, now I can't enjoy it.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like always been my experience with Danny McBride characters. I mean, some of the projects that he's in, I'll enjoy, but there's always something really skeevy about him that kind of keeps me from sort of enjoying it to full extent. And you know, there's hints of that here, but not nearly in the same way. Just before I forget, that guy who plays Keith played Ozzy Osbourne in that Motley Crue biopic everybody was talking about. Before. And he, now that I see it, if you just add a lot of, you know, raccoon eye makeup around, that's good casting. It's kind of funny, Sarah, that you were saying about the comedy aspect of it, that you wanted it to be funnier if they were, you know, going to go one way or the other. I found as the season went along and actually it becomes earnest in points, I found that was actually the compelling direction for me, that kept me going.
Yeah, that would work better for me. I will take your word for it.
It's weird that like maybe the answer for Danny McBride shows is for Danny and McBride to not be in them, because he's clearly very creative. Like, he created this show, created all of these other shows. So we've talked about Vice Principals and Eastbound and Down. But he, as an actor, I would say, given the evidence that we have thus far, his range is very small. Like, all his characters are kind of samey. They're all these like obnoxious, blustery idiots. There's one shot where he walks in with Calvin into his house and he's like trying to like pose for his wife. And he's just holding his fists, like his arms sort of half bent and like his fists in front of his pockets, but not in his pockets. It's like this weird. And I was like, this is such a weird choice, but that's a Danny McBride character to me, like top to bottom. That's this guy. So I just wonder how different the show would be if like someone else had played that character, or the character was not in the show.
Justin Theroux, because he can play that gross character and get away with it. And you get McBride to write it, you get somebody else to perform it. Maybe that's more of a panel crowd pleaser, but I still liked it.
Yeah.
I would have gone Matthew Perry. I don't feel confident he could do the accent, but
yeah, I don't think he's got the range. It's a split. Sounds like a split decision. I would say, like, I feel like the show matures, expands, and evolves in a very appealing way that I enjoyed, and I'm looking forward to watching more.
Yeah, I agree. I was very surprised by my reaction to it, but this does seem to be the like deepest, it's weird to say that, but deepest character study that he's done that I know of. Granted, I've only dipped a toe in, but the fact that it held my interest for this long is like already a departure from everything else he's done on HBO. So yeah, I was surprised to be in, but I'm in too.
All right, that means it is time to go around the dial talking about something we're watching on TV lately. First up, Tara Ariano.
We didn't talk about this last week because I was out of town, so we had to catch up on it. But Lodge 49 is back on AMC Monday nights. We talked about this when it premiered last year with Adam Sternberg. It miraculously lasted an entire season and got a second season despite being extremely weird and unique and off, different from really every other show on TV, honestly. So where we pick up, Dud, the Wyatt Russell character, is recovering from a shark attack in the season one finale. He had a falling out with Ernie, his mentor at the lodge, who is in the middle of a career and identity crisis. His sister Liz has started a new phase in her career, and a new family-owned pool store has taken over the old Dudley and Son location at the strip mall, and they are true monsters. Especially the kid who plays their son, Bowie, who has a basically subhuman character to play and really goes for it. Like, he commits to this total shithead. Yeah. The Lynx organization in England and mystical Lynx lore. This is the name of the titular lodge. They are known as Lynxes, or just Lynx, I guess. All of that gets fleshed out a bit more, although I feel like that part of the story is weaker this season. Dave, you're going to jump in when I finish this so you can say if you agree or not. But we also learn more about what people in Long Beach are doing for money now. And of course, can't believe it took this long. There is a multi-level marketing scheme for a product called Phydro with an F, which combines the powers of water and fire.
Oh, God.
And it's wild that the second season of Succession and Lodge 49 came back on back-to-back nights, because both are about American life and late capitalism, but Succession is about people in the like 0.00001% scrambling to secure their positions, and Lodge 49 is about all of the skulls, as Tom called it, them in the latest episode of Succession, that they have to fuck to do it. So watching the two back-to-back, it's very instructive. Dave, you watched the first four to have aired so far. What did you think?
Yeah, I guess if season one was about discovery, I guess season two is setting up to be the quest season, where they are actually going on this quest to find the answer and what the answer is, whether it's, you know, the secret to alchemy or it's just a code for Bitcoin or whatever it happens to end up being. But that's obviously the journey is the thing and not the actual destination. That seems to be sort of like the narrative thrust at this one. But like, as we were watching it, you described it as like this little precious gem of a TV show. And it's really true. Like it's a very small set show. It's not happening on a grand stage, even though like some of the mysticism and the stonemasonry sort of aspect of it seem large, but actually the stories are very, very small. And that's part of its charm. You know, like there's all this secret Masonic stuff happening, but the sister's trying to get a job at a steakhouse and like what's happening there. And it's such a unique blend of high and low, of big and small, that it just really shouldn't exist, or really like shouldn't have even like lasted this long, but it has. I'm really happy for it. And the people that sort of drift in and out of the stories do so effortlessly. And part of it is that sort of bum culture that is part of it, thanks to Dud. And a lot of it is just that, you know, these are people that are just kind of scraping by. And a lot of them, especially in season two, are sort of like on the road to defeat. So that kind of plays into sort of the show has a certain hum to it, you know, that is sort of weirdly comforting, you know, and I don't know where the show is going, which is really refreshing. Like it feels like it should be a mystery box show, but it's not.
Yeah.
And I really like that about it. Like it is not a J.J. Abrams, what is the scroll all about? It's really, what is the scroll doing to let us discover more about this rich cast? And that's great.
Yeah, I saw a headline about its return where it said that they're aiming to make it the least aspirational show on television. And it definitely is.
Yeah.
I mean, these are downwardly mobile people. But they still, I mean, the point of it to me is like, and partly it's the setting too. But again, to return to like Succession versus Lodge 49, like Succession has this very dark brown autumnal, like decline, decay, destruction light to it. And Lodge 49, I mean, set in Long Beach, like it's so bright. Even the guy who comes from England to try and set their lodge back in order, like just falls in love with it. And he just like doesn't want to leave, gets a tan, gets a sunburn.
But they did a certain thing with the film grade, which is something I noticed just from like my photo experience. And if this means something to you, it means something to you. It's bright, but the highlights have been crushed. So it's bright, but the brightness is dimmer than it should be.
Yeah, it's bright, but it's a hard light,
yes,
for sure. Mm-hmm. But there's also these moments of like just, you know, joy and togetherness. And that's the point of the lodge, is like lonely people finding each other and finding community. And there's an episode where Dud tries to revive his pool cleaning business by just like going around to his old rounds and offering to clean for half the price of what Bowie is charging. And then eventually like just doing it for free, and then doing it for like a bag of lemons. And then he takes the lemons to the lodge and is like, can I get a beer for this? Sure. And then he's like buying beers for everyone else with his lemons. And then the sovereign protector comes in and gets all mad at them that they're not paying their tabs. And they're like, too bad, we're on the lemon standard now. Like it's stuff like that. It's very cute.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a sweet show. If you tried it out last season and fell away from it, it's definitely worth catching up on. It's Monday nights on AMC. It's lovely. Mm-hmm. And for my plug, we mentioned this a couple weeks ago. Again, with this, our podcast on Beverly Hills 90210 is covering the current BH90210 revival / reboot. So we've had good luck with screeners so far. Touch wood. I'm literally touching wood right now. So we've been able to put those out immediately after air. So if you are not interested in the old show but want to know what the hell is going on with the new one, we are here for you. So check that out again with this where you find podcasts.
All right, Adam, it's your turn. Ooh, branded transitions. Adam Sternberg, nice. What do you got?
Well, first of all, I want to say, speaking of shows that you talked about previously with Adam Sternberg, I need to say that I was right about Chernobyl. I feel vindicated by the world's reception of Chernobyl. It was good. It was definitely the nuclear meltdown miniseries of the year. I think looking back, we can all agree. In terms of what I'm watching, the shows that I've been watching recently are all ones that you guys have already talked about. I finished watching The Boys.
Well, that's okay. We didn't talk about them with you.
I finished watching The Boys on Amazon, but here's the thing. I kind of agree with everything you guys already said about it. I liked The Boys a lot. I liked it a lot more than I thought I would. I was a little bit worried that what if superheroes were really bad? Genre, like the televangelist genre, is a little bit frayed around the edges now. And I'm curious to see with the HBO Watchmen show coming out, it feels like it's going to be in a similar territory, not tonally necessarily, but that idea, like the Watchmen comic book is about as old as Jim Baker scandal. And so I was a little worried that it was going to feel familiar, but I quite liked it. I thought tonally it was really smart, and I really liked the performances. I was glad that you called out the guy who plays Homelander because he's kind of great. Yeah. And he reminds me of like a weird zombie Bradley Cooper in that show.
Yes.
Adam, we did a Star Trek recast for, might have been on the Patreon feed, but I put Homelander actor up for a new Kirk. If you replace the malice with sort of that suave quality to him, I think he could be a new Kirk.
Yeah, and I had also watched Banshee, and I honestly barely remember him from that show. Like when you guys mentioned that he was on Banshee, I was like, he was? But he's great. I thought that, you know, there was moments with the gore and the stuff where it was like a little bit further than maybe I would have taken it myself. But, overall, I like
Laser Baby.
But Laser Baby, yeah. And it was actually, I really enjoyed it. And so it's sitting there on Amazon for people who want to watch it. The other show that I was also watching, which you also addressed, is Years and Years, which I also agree with what you guys said. I actually bailed on that show about three episodes in because I was like, the premise of the show is basically like, what if your Twitter feed, but worse? So you come home at the end of the day, you're like, wow, the world is terrible. Now I'm going to watch this show about the world being even more terribler. Mm-hmm. And it did feel like a weird mishmash of like it's like Children of Men, but it's also Black Mirror, and it's also, and so I think I will go and finish watching it, but I literally just stopped watching it because I just found it too anxiety provoking and kind of all over the place.
No, watch Lodge 49 instead.
It was all over the place, but somehow by the numbers too. Like somehow it managed to be both at once. It was so predictable in its randomness. Let's take everything that could go wrong, make sure it does go wrong, and make these six characters experience it all. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, and I did feel like, I mean, there was parts of the first episode that I quite liked, and then there was parts that I thought were actually sort of laugh out loud ridiculous, like the premise that the instigation of nuclear war is an excellent time for you to be like, I am going to have sex with that hot Ukrainian guy. Damn it. I got to do it. So it was a little bit all over the place. But I may go back. It's because it's a short season. I may go back and revisit it. It also has replaced This Is Us in my head as the most generically titled TV show that I can never quite remember what it's called. I always refer to it Year After Year. And then I'm like, no, it's called Years. These Are the Years. Years.
It's the once and again, now and then of, or now and then, now and again.
Now and again.
Here and now.
Speaking of John Goodman.
And then I, for my plug, I haven't done anything interesting since last time I was with you guys. So I'm going to plug something that is not mine, but which people can consider a little bit of homework assignment for.
Well, after hold on, because bring episode. It up when we bring it up when we talk about the.
Should I wait? All right.
Yeah, bring it up then, because I also mentioned that while we were watching this episode too.
Zip.
Adam, didn't you just get a new job?
I did, but I can't really plug it.
Why not?
Go. Yes, I got a new job. I'm now working at the New York Times, the failing
Heard
New York
of
Times.
It? Check it out.
so please go subscribe to the New York Times. I actually will, since you backed me into a corner, I will plug this big package, which I personally had nothing to do with. I arrived literally as they were finishing it, but the magazine where I'm working, they just finished this thing called the 1619 Project, and
yes.
It's a huge so undertaking about the history of slavery, the 400th year anniversary of the first slave ship arriving in America. I dove into it and read it. It's really fascinating. There's a lot of people talking about it online, both mostly pro, some con, but definitely worth checking out. Like, if you're a fan of history, if you're a fan like Dave, I know you like those Jared Diamond books, those sorts of things mm-hmm. about like unexpected connections between things and stuff like right. that. It's more that than anything else. It just reframes your idea of the role that slavery's played in all sorts of different institutions, capitalism and city planning and all these sorts of things. So I plug that, even though I personally had nothing to do with it.
that was for myself. Sarah D. Bunting.
Well done. I am here to talk about yet another football documentary. Did I go to a secondary school with football at it? I did not. Do I care about college or high school football or the NFL? I do not. Put a football documentary on Netflix. I am in. Adult diaper will not move for 8 hours. This time I'm talking about QB1 Beyond the Lights. This should not be confused with Last Chance U, which is the one about junior college prospective recruits trying to rehabilitate themselves for Division I careers. This is the high school football one that started out on some like AT&T only network that you could like only watch on your phone.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of seasons back, it moved to Netflix between seasons 1 and 2. Doesn't matter. Netflix is where you can find all the seasons now. Should you bother? If you have never watched it before, seasons 1 and 2 are good. If you liked Last Chance U, you will enjoy this. Season 3, I don't know. Like, we're partway through it, my husband and I, and we were just kind of like, we just kept looking at each other like, eh? It may be suffering from watching it so soon after Last Chance U, which dropped its most recent season like a couple of months ago. I did talk about it on here. Season 3 of QB1, there's so many numbers, sorry, and letters. Season 3, I don't know. First of all, you're not given great context for what's happening on the field, which Last Chance U is really good at locating someone who is like there for the drama of the sport, but doesn't necessarily know the sport on a micro level. The football is explained pretty well. Maybe they just have a really good local announcer at that particular college, and this is on variable local high school announcers. I don't know. Not everyone watching this is a gridiron head, so the occasional Chiron or something would be helpful. Mostly, though, I think the problem is that the kids just aren't as likable in this third season. It is important to remember that these are kids, but in season 3, two of the subjects really remind you how glad you are not to be in high school anymore in the way that they are being kids. And the third one seems like a very nice, solid young man, but also rather retiring, which is not great TV. His mom is very charismatic, but it's not called QB Mom, unfortunately. Dan and I were about to quit for the season with like 3 episodes to go when one of the quarterbacks basically disappeared from practice, school, and the show with a mealy-mouthed explanation about his MCL, and even his coach like probably knew what happened, but for FERPA reasons was not allowed to say what happened and what was going on with the discipline. So as cliffhangers go, that was well timed by the show, because I guess we're going to finish it out and see what happens with this dude. But overall, QB1 might be better served reassigning the time it spends with one quarterback's family at their noxious Hillsong-y mega church, as a matter of fact, or on their leisure activities, or like, I don't need to see this kid jumping off of buoys, as it happens, in Parkland, Florida. Like, that's never talked about. I don't know. Like, Last Chance U was just so much better at giving the kind of context from academic counselors, from teachers and teammates and Pop Warner coaches and whoever, on the quarterback's relative talents and their prospects and the, you know, crazy fucked up system that has tentacles going all the way down to when these kids are really kids, like 5 years old. The Last Chance U was just better at that. And this is just kind of a choppy tone poem about being a senior. And the tone in question is often male privilege. Like, does the show want to talk about the fact that some of these high schools have dedicated football coaching staffs larger than my high school's entire faculty? And what that means for the future of the sport and the people in it? And the different experiences of the white quarterback and the African-American quarterback. And there's just too much nonfiction TV to settle for something like this that isn't going to unpack itself a little more thoroughly. So it's still an okay show. And the first two seasons are quite good and compelling. So if you've not watched it before, watch those. And if you have watched it before and we're saving season three, don't. Clear to skip it. Watch something else instead. Or read something else, like my coverage of the Animal Kingdom finale at primetimer.com, which should be up by the time you're listening to this. I think when we talked about Lodge 49 last, I was wondering if those two universes were like coexisting, and I sort of was hoping for a crossover. This season has been something of a trial, and I really think that they should just merge into the Lodge 49iverse and kill some people off. But you can read more about that at Primetimer, as well as a conversation that I had with our great good friend John Ramos on the occasion of the My So-Called Life anniversary, on who is really the heart of the show. Spoiler, we don't think it's Angela. So check that out, primetimer.com.
It's time for the Canon, a user submission this week. Let's have a listen.
Hi, Caroline here to present for the Canon A Study in Pink, Episode 1 of the BBC series Sherlock. Although Series 4 was a huge letdown for fans, the rest of the series was a huge success of the last decade. An argument for the Canon can be made for at least three different episodes, in my opinion, but I decided to focus on the first one, since it establishes all that we love about it. So I'll try to make an argument for it, Tara style, by making a list of points. Point number one. The innovative aspect of the series cannot be overstated. Although now we take it for granted, the imaginative way to convey information through text messages appearing on screen, as well as maps, was really fun and efficient. It seems all the more appropriate for a character like Sherlock, whose mind registers things so fast, faster than words anyway. This has been used for comedic effect on other series later. I'm thinking of Jane the Virgin in particular. Point number two. The great adaptation of the 19th century classic into a crime series of the 2010s. As an English teacher, I enjoyed specifically Sherlock's analysis of Watson's background, as it is almost word for word the analysis made in the novel, only instead of the pocket watch, here it is his mobile phone. It is sad to notice how no adaptation was needed in terms of where Watson was fighting. 120 years later, it is still possible to use Afghanistan as the place where he was wounded. Point number three, the story itself is fast-paced and interesting, even if the main point one could argue against the episode is the lack of Moriarty. But it sets the stakes and gives us a tight little mystery. I personally enjoy Sherlock's confrontation with the cab driver because the poison pill conversation reminds me of one of my favorite moments in the film Princess Bride, the iocane powder duel between Wesley and Vizzini. Point number four, the dialogue is sharp and endlessly quotable, from Sherlock's very fast, matter-of-fact insults to people.
Ah, Molly, coffee, thank you. What happened to the lipstick?
It wasn't working for me.
Really? I thought it was a big improvement. Mouth's too small now.
Okay.
Two is delivery when he explains what's what to the mere mortals around him.
Is that it?
Is that what?
We only just met. We're going to go look at a flat.
Problem?
We don't know a thing about each other. I don't know where we're meeting. I don't even know your name.
I know you're an army doctor and you've been invalided home from Afghanistan. I know you've got a brother who's worried about you, but you won't go to him for help because you don't approve of him, possibly because he's an alcoholic, more likely because he recently walked out on his wife. And I know that your therapist thinks you're limp psychosomatic quite correctly, I'm afraid. It's enough to be going on with, don't you think? The name's Sherlock Holmes and the address is 221B Baker Street. Afternoon.
Point number five. The absolute pleasure of seeing two seriously amazing actors get an opportunity to display their talent to the world, and the miracle of their chemistry. Sherlock Holmes endures because of the beauty of the bond between these two characters, and to see them here, clearly having so much fun, is a real delight. I think we all fell in love with Cinnamon Toast and Crunch after his first fast-paced speech, followed by the whimsical wink. Watson didn't stand a chance. As for the minor quibbles, I would note the annoyance of Watson when people assume that they are a couple, but I think it is balanced out by him striking out not once, but twice, with Mycroft's sexy spy assistant. Also, this episode was made in 2010, so it seems weird to us now that Sherlock has to explain what a smartphone is and does. But all in all, this is a superb moment of TV. So what say you?
Well, shall we start with our guest who picked this episode from the available user submissions?
Yes. Why don't we?
All right, Adam.
Sure. It's so nice to be here on the other side of the table with you. This feels so good. To be a judge. You know, it's funny with this. I picked it. I have watched episodes of Sherlock before, and I've enjoyed the show. I'm not a fanatic, and I have not watched it all the way from beginning to end. And in fact, rewatching this one, I wasn't even sure if I was rewatching it. I'm not sure if I saw this one before, but I really went into it with a surprisingly open mind in the sense that I wasn't sure which way I was leaning, if it was canon worthy or not. And then I watched the episode and I came out the end of it feeling sort of the same way. There was things about it that I really liked. I struggled a little bit with the way in which it does feel a bit dated, even though the show, I mean, I guess it's almost 10 years old now. I think it was released at least here in 2010. And as the presenter noted, there were some very innovative techniques that the show used in terms of showing the texting and the floating words and everything, which I remember when I first watched the show, I thought were quite clever. But now it's hard to watch because they've been adopted. So it's a bit like the Matrix bullet time. It's really hard to remember what it felt like the first time you saw it because you've seen so many iterations and parodies of it.
But also, don't you think that it was sort of like they had new toy-itis that they discovered this great method and then they kind of overused it in the episode? Like, I thought it was very clever with when they used it to convey what was happening on screens, but then they kind of went overboard at some point with like the wet and dry.
I totally agree. I actually made that note that I thought the texting was really smart, but then when he was doing the thing with the where he's sort of examining the body and then it's sort of showing you what he's thinking, I thought that hasn't aged well as a technique. Yeah. I see that it solves a problem of dramatizing Sherlock Holmes, which is, you know, that it's a show about deduction and but I felt like those elements of the show have not aged that well. It's also hard to watch because this show feels in some ways like the culmination of the kind of cranky bastard genius genre that's become so popular, yeah. like House and all those kinds of shows. And but again, it's hard to dock it points for that because so many of those shows are basically ripoffs of the original Sherlock Holmes idea, right? Mm-hmm. Like House is basically Sherlock Holmes as a doctor. But I'm not sure that the kind of dynamic of Benedict Cumberbatch being such a jerk to everyone feels as fresh now as it did then. And I don't know that it was entirely fresh then either. However, I will say ultimately what saved it for me and what really shone through, and the presenter mentioned this, is the two lead actors, like Martin Freeman and Benedict Cumberbatch, are such a good match. And specifically, it was really fun for me to watch Benedict Cumberbatch at this moment when no one knew who he was, and his particular style of acting and his charm was, this is basically where most people, I think, discovered him. And so to watch like young Benedict Cumberbatch just having so much fun with this role, to me was really enjoyable. And I have to say, you know, for an hour and a half episode of television, I was taken in by it. I enjoyed it. And ultimately, I felt like it was like very well designed episode. You know, if you have like a high level of tolerance for sort of corny deductive games. Mm-hmm. But so even when I came out of it, I wasn't quite sure which way I would go. And I thought, well, I'm going to listen to the presentation and see if that tips me one way or the other. So I'm not going to tell you which way I'm going to go right now. But those were my general feelings about it. Is this when I should tell everyone about the podcast?
Sure.
The yes. John Locke. So the other thing I was going to mention, and I wondered if the presenter was in some way referencing this by saying that season four was a huge letdown. I came to this through this podcast episode of this podcast called Dakota Ring that Willa Paskin, the TV critic at Slate, does. But she talked about the whole John Locke conspiracy, the TJLC, and this online community of Sherlock fans who came to believe so fervently that the show was essentially sending this message that Watson and Sherlock were a couple and that they were going to end up together, that it sort of reached a kind of QAnon level of like fanaticism, to the point where the show's creators were saying like, no, no, it's literally not going to happen. Please believe us. And they're like, it's happening. All right. and I highly recommend, if you're interested in Sherlock and you don't know about John Locke, or you're interested in that, or the general subject of shipping and fan service, that episode of Dakota Ring is really, really good. And I found it so interesting. And it's a really interesting lens to look at this show. However, it doesn't have that much to do with whether or not I think this episode, particularly because it's the first one,
right,
should get into the canon.
I just want to co-sign that. When we finished this episode, I mentioned that to Dave as well and was trying to explain the story. And like, you're right, QAnon is a perfect example of like that's how impossible it is to summarize briefly, like the level of crazers that is documented here. Decoder Ring is a great podcast, but we'll link to that specific episode in the show notes.
Like, I went into that episode thinking, like, I know about shipping and I know about slash fiction. And, like, I know that, I know about that stuff. But the layers of, like, magnitude beyond that it goes.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The deepness of the conspiracy and the 48-part YouTube videos explaining
it
and everything.
God.
And
it's
the
fucking
people,
wild.
The, like, relationships are destroyed and people are doxxed and stuff. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
It's really worth listening to.
Mm-hmm. Sarah is our crime person, so she should go next, I feel.
Well, it's always nice to hear from Caroline. And she like had all of the points that I wrote down basically in order. I think that this sort of reminds me of when we would go to the video store as kids, ask your parents, my mother would let us get whatever fucking Corey garbage we wanted to get, and then she would make us get a classic and watch it, which is how we wind up watching Citizen Kane. And my brother and I are being such dicks about it. We're like, oh, big whoop, it's a focus pull. And she paused it. And she's like, he invented that and basically everything else. Shut the fuck up, eyes front. God bless Barb. Anyway, this the experience of coming back to this episode sort of reminded me of that. Like, she's right that a lot of the things haven't necessarily aged well. And the points that Adam made about, like, now we've seen this done so many times that it seems like a who cares-er. But this was the first time watching this premiere that I had really felt like the reality of mobile phones in our lives was integrated into a TV show without sacrificing narrative tension. Mm-hmm. And you weren't having that thing where, like, people were just showing up at each other's apartments and that bullshit that I was like, finally, someone figured out how to make this visual in a realistic way that's not too clever. Now it seems a little too clever, but at the time, it really was like solving a serious problem. And this was also a show that, like, firmly and immediately grabbed the lapels of an entire culture and did not let go until the fourth season sort of sucked. But I still occasionally, like, if there's nothing on and I just want to have something on while I'm, like, paying bills, I'll just put on an old Sherlock. All of Caroline's points are so well taken. And while I do have some nitpicks, I do think the last half hour is a little long.
Yep.
Should have been maybe an hour and 10.
Yep.
There are some performances in the secondary cast that are not good. But I think that this has canonical importance for our purposes as the first of its kind and a show that set new standards. It was sort of like the best of a certain kind of the cranky genius genre that Adam mentioned, and that it owned our anticipation for some years. And now that both these dudes are huge stars, is this why? I don't know, but I think it is. I think it is significant, if not perfect. Tara.
I don't have much to ask. I agree. I agree. Caroline made a wonderful presentation. I would just add, in terms of nitpicks, and these might be the ones that you're thinking of, that it's extremely obvious from the very start that the killer is going to turn out to be a cab driver. So that reveal is not that shocking to me. The other worst use of technology in the episode is when they spot the cab and they're chasing it through town, and like it's flashing between them on the street and then the maps, and it's like so frenetic and it's so overdone. And it's like, we fucking get it. That's
Batman
a chase
begins.
Scene. Like, we're you didn't invent chase scenes.
That is a rough montage. Yes.
Yeah.
It's like literally hard to watch in that it's like, you know, seizure inducing, but everything else, like,
sorry, just one moment in the montage where like they have to jump like a small gap between buildings. Sherlock does it. And then Watson comes and he's like hesitating because he's like, oh, my leg. And they use like the walk, don't walk guys. Like, they were like mixing visual metaphors as they were presenting this chase. Yeah. It was an odd choice.
Yeah, that is a low point, but everything else, I think it really was very special when it started. And the first three seasons really were special, I think. I mean, you know, it came and went, I would say, but it was a cultural phenomenon for good reason. And what I said to Dave when it ended was, what a pleasure to watch this very first episode before it became freighted with all of its bad fandom. That really was, as Adam said, a problem. But, you know, that's not totally the show's fault, and this is certainly an extremely strong series premiere, so thank you for bringing it to us, Dave.
Yeah, I haven't been back to Sherlock since it wrapped up its last season, and the last season was just
wrapped
like,
up
like,
its last season. Yeah,
its last season with its fun house of mystery. I'm like, oh god.
Oh,
just like
brutal.
No. So this was a great excuse to get back to the beginning, and I'm trying to think of what the other episodes that she might have picked. I think the first one with the mistress would be one of my choices. Not sure about the next one. But for me, like, the main takeaway after rewatching the pilot was how infectious this energy is. And it's partly Cumberbatch just being sort of a gleeful, manic personality is partly the music, which is often imitated now, I find. Like, I hear those notes in a lot of TV shows since.
That Calliope,
Warrior recently did it, and I like it.
Pennyworth.
Pennyworth, yeah. So for me, just like how fun it is was great to come back to. I agree that the first half of the episode is much better than the second half. When the actual serial killer cabbie gets on the screen, I feel it does get a bit bogged down with that mystery. And the mystery for this pilot episode, because the episode's focus is really split between doing character introductions justice and actually having a functional mystery. And the mystery, as it goes for Sherlock, is definitely like a minor one. And it ends with a gunshot too, which is like very different from what you would expect. Although I did like that beat, and it kind of really places Watson in the show in a meaningful way. The technology stuff, it just reminded me of how good the show was when it started out and how new it seemed and just how fun it was, and that they seemed to be having a good time in the sandbox they made. And it's like a really serviceable update of the material. Like Sherlock Holmes prior to this, like you had Robert Downey Jr. with his Mortal Kombat X-ray stuff, which and then he had all these stodgy things I couldn't stand as a kid. So I was never really into Sherlock Holmes in any way, but this like really sold me on the concept. So no small feat. I really enjoyed it, and I was happy to revisit. So let's put this to the official vote. We still have some mystery votes. Let's work this backwards. I will say yes, Tara.
I will also say yes, and just add, if you're missing that Sherlock energy, Dave and I talked about it back when we had Allison on earlier in the spring to talk about White Dragon, and we did our foreign crime show roundup, but Miss Sherlock is still on HBO. It's the Japanese adaptation of it where Sherlock and Watson are both ladies, and it's super fun. So I just want to side recommend that, but yes, my vote is yes.
Good recommendation. Sarah?
It is a yes for me.
All right, Adam Sternberg.
My inconsequential vote. I do want to say that hearing Dave talk about it, I want to subtract one half demerit point from the episode, because unless I missed it, they never actually do explain how the cabbie always knows which one is the one, right? Like, it's sort of left open, and Sherlock's left in that moment of like, did I get it right? Did I get it right? Which was a tiny bit unsatisfying. Did I miss it?
Nope.
Okay. However, I still... we'll vote yes.
All right. Woo. That means it's a sweep. Sherlock, Series 1, Episode 1, A Study in Pink. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hagrid Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time to find out our winner and loser of the week. Sarah, who is our winner?
I really can't believe that this is on the winning side, but St. Elmo's Fire is getting a series adaptation at NBC. I'm not sure how long it will stay a winner, because they're doing a modern adaptation. That therefore means it's the same Boro Monoclef shite as like 16 other new shows are going to be, like 20 somethings, Lives and Loves. Just let it be in the 80s so that we can enjoy the outfits, and then have Rob Lowe as like someone's boss or something, or himself still with that hair, or BH90210 it. St. Elmo, St. 9021 Elmo. I don't know. Anyway, good for them, and good for that theme song, I guess. John Parr making a little more money. But yes, that is the winner for now.
I mean, the question is, like, you know, the truism is bad movies make good remakes. It's the Ocean's 11 principle. And St. Elmo's Fire, I mean, I love it, but it is a bad movie.
Oh, like, it sucks. Oh, no.
It doesn't even really
I'm not trying to be
plot.
Like, you know, don't touch the hem of this sacred document's garment or anything like that. I just don't.
I
don't see the point if you're not going to make it a period piece.
Yeah.
I bet the song made more money than the movie.
Oh, yeah, probably. It did.
It's in my head right now, and will be, I'm
mine
sure,
too.
The next week.
Man in Motion.
All right, who's our loser, Tara?
Well, Our loser's friends, but it's kind of a long story. So an unnamed former employee of Robert De Niro's production company has been sued, probably primarily for embezzling money. But the reason that it's being reported is that she's also being sued for having watched hours of TV on Netflix while she was supposed to be working. And even though she watched Arrested Development for like 7 hours and Schitt's Creek for like, you know, 3.5 hours or something, I think that someone figured out it was like basically a whole season of Schitt's Creek. The one that's getting mentioned the most in headlines is Friends. Now, is 55 hours of Friends in 4 days at work a lot? Yes, but it's not Friends' fault. It's a good ass show. I watch that much in a week, probably. No one can tell me otherwise.
I was going to say that sounds like she just left it on, but we all know.
Yeah.
Are you still watching?
That sounds like a day ending in Y in Tara's office. I'm not sure.
I mean, I usually just have the TV on TBS.
Should I sue you?
It's on all the time, even if I'm not watching it. It's comforting to just know it's there. Anyway,
I understand.
Yeah. It's bad press for Friends. It's not Friends' fault. Don't watch TV at work, I guess, is the takeaway. I don't know. It's not my rule.
Guys, you know what time it is?
Get me Steven Spielberg.
He's unavailable.
Then get me his non-union Mexican equivalent.
Ooh.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the fifth game time of the season. Our scores are Tara 2, Sarah 1, Valued Guests 1. Today we are playing non-union Mexican equivalent from David Snyder, who earns himself an extra credit column. You'll remember David as the organizer of the Star Trek crew draft from last year.
Did
I win that one? Hey, buddy.
I think I won that one.
I believe so.
This game tests your knowledge of the actors who portrayed the TV version of characters who were previously portrayed in movies.
Hey,
I will start by giving you the name of a movie and an actor who appeared in it. For 2 points, you give me the name of the actor who portrayed the same character on TV.
Okay.
If you need a hint, I will give you the name of the shared character and the name of another show that actor played a significant role in. Correct answers after the hint are worth 1 point. So here's an example. Working Girl, Melanie Griffith.
Sandra Bullock.
That would be how the show, I mean, how the game works. Any questions?
Can we guess for free?
Yes. Let's say yes. Okay. Answers here are never the same actor from the movie. I'm always looking for a different actor, even if the original movie actor may have appeared as a character on TV at some point. So let's find the steel meal situation, please, Tara Ariano.
I have 2 steel meals. End of situation.
All right. Let's throw it to Picky to see who's going first.
We will start with valued guest.
All right. Adam is going first, followed by Sarah, then Tara. Are we ready to play non-union Mexican equivalent?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Adam, we're going to start you off with some easy ones. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Christy Swanson. Name the actor that was on TV in the same role.
Sarah Michelle Gellar.
And that is worth 2 points, and that's how you do it.
Yes.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Perfect. Textbook.
Silence of the Lambs, Anthony Hopkins.
Mads Mikkelsen.
Correct. That's nice. Hannibal Lecter. Tara. Mm-hmm. Psycho, Anthony Perkins.
Oh, fuck. What was this little puke's name? Freddie Highmore.
Freddie Highmore played Norman Bates on Bates Motel. Back to Adam. Everything's tied up 2 apiece. Stargate, Kurt Russell.
I can picture his face if it's the guy I think it is. You're going to tell me, if I ask for a hint, you're going to tell me the name of the character and a different show that he was on, right?
That's correct.
I don't think that's going to help me.
You know who he is, you just don't know the name.
Richard. It's not Richard. Richard Brown.
Oh, man. It is there in your brain. All right. Let's give you the clues just in case it rattles something. The character is Jonathan Jack O'Neill. And the other show that this person is definitely known for is MacGyver.
Oh, I don't remember his name.
Yeah. It's one of those guys with a lot of first names.
Richard Dean. Richard Dean something.
Yeah, Richard Dean. Yep.
If I just keep saying first names, Richard Dean Johnson, Richard Dean Anderson.
I felt for you on that one. I could tell that it was ready to drip out of your nose onto the answer Kleenex.
There's no half point for just being able to picture the person in your head. I don't get like a quarter point because I swear that's who I was thinking.
Answer Kleenex.
No quarter points in this game. I'm sorry. All right. Sarah D. Bunting. Terminator Linda Hamilton.
Oh my God. Linda Hamilton, who played Sarah Connor. And I watched this show, and I know that mofo Brian Austin Green was on the show, but now I don't remember who played her, so can I have a hint, please?
All right. The character is indeed Sarah Connors, and this person was a big deal on Game of Thrones.
Yeah, that helps. Just kidding. It doesn't. Lena Headey.
Ding.
Really?
Yep.
That's awesome.
1 point.
All right, back
to Tara.
Yes.
Here's a unique question that has three possible answers for you.
Oh.
Your movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Your actor, okay. Harrison Ford.
Oh.
Talk us through it.
I know the kid from who played him in Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. And it's like, there's a Sean and a Flannery. And I think there's another name in there, and I don't know what it is.
All right, well, give me something I could buzz or ding you on.
Sean Flannery Scott.
I'm going to give you Sean Flannery. Sean Patrick Flannery is
his
name.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's Richard Dean Patrick Sean Flannery.
There was like an 89-year-old Indiana Jones in that show. He had an eye patch. He dressed the same as Raiders Indiana Jones, except he like could barely walk in an eye patch. It was kind of funny. All right, that's good. That's worth 2 points. Adam, Dirty Dancing Jennifer Grey.
Oh boy, that was a Dirty Dancing TV show, huh? Apparently. I'll take the clue, please.
All right, Francis Baby Kellerman is the character, and the show that this person was on, The Office.
Oh.
On The Office, but not on the opening credits, but still a pretty major character if I'm
okay. Well, then I'm going to have to say Sandra Bullock.
Incorrect. Anybody want to hazard a guess there?
Is it Melora Hardin?
Yes, it is. And that's Jen, right? Or Jan.
Jan.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, every time I think about that actor, I just think about that super cringy dinner party.
The dinner party?
Episode. Oh. Yeah. Sarah D. Bunting, Dangerous Minds, Michelle Pfeiffer. We're looking for the actor who shared the role with her on TV.
I don't know the answer to that, so I'm going to say Richard Dean Anderson.
Close.
And get the hint.
All right, the hint. Luann Johnson is the character. Another show this person was involved in, Designing Women. So, played the Michelle Pfeiffer character on the TV version of Dangerous Minds.
Jean Smart?
Decent guess. Annie Potts. Annie Potts.
Huh. Okay.
For some reason, I was picturing Jennifer Esposito. She was probably too young, but that would be better. In my opinion.
For sure.
Yeah. I've been organizing these roughly by genre. So these are the action drama ones, in case you're wondering.
Okay. Okay.
Doesn't really matter, but here's your star. The Dead Zone, okay. Christopher Walken.
Anthony Michael Hall.
Is correct.
I watched every fucking episode of that.
Wow.
Yeah.
You and Kim Reed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Adam Sternberg, Lethal Weapon, Danny Glover.
Oh, I believe it's a weigh in. I'm going to weigh in. It's a weigh in. It's,
Adam, I'm giving you that quarter point from earlier and I'm taking it back for weigh in, just so you know.
It's well, if he's playing Murdaugh, he's too old for this shit. He must be old Wayan. He must be Damon Wayan.
Yeah.
You are correct. 2 points. Well done. Sarah D. Bunting, the movie La Femme Nikita, your actor, Anne Perillo.
Perilla, I think.
No, I looked it up. Perillo is how you pronounce it.
Oh my God. I don't know the answer to this, and I'm pretty sure I know what hint I'm going to get, and I'm still not going to know, but let's say that she was played by Benson, and then give me the hint, please.
All right. The character is Nikita, and we have two possible answers, so I'm giving you two possible shows. Johnny Zero, which apparently was a show, or Designated Survivor.
Not where I thought it was going to go, and really not helpful.
Not helpful.
So this is Sandra Bullock, obviously.
It is not. We were looking for either Peta Wilson or Maggie Q.
Oh, right. Yeah. I forgot to read that again.
All right. Here's our last question before our first score break. It is for Tara. The movie In the Heat of the Night, the actor Rod Steiger.
Carol O'Connor.
2 points, and now our first score break, please.
Okay, I have 8 points. Adam has 4 points. Sarah has 3 points.
All right, Sarah, that means you are in. Audible gasp for some reason.
That was mine.
I am holding in my hand the Trivial Pursuit TV box question from the mid-90s or so. We're not quite exactly sure of its published date. I will read you all 6 questions. If you get 3 of them correctly, you will get 4 points. Are you ready?
Woo!
I am.
Classics category is first. Who first anchored CBS news coverage of the 1952 National Political Conventions?
Fred Friendly.
You should have thought about that for 1 second. That's Walter Cronkite.
Oh.
Sitcoms. Yeah, fuck him. What branch of the military did Dobie Gillis and Menard G. Krebs enlist in? What branch of the military?
The Navy.
Army.
Dope.
What record-breaking series did Lorimar first air in the spring of 1978? And I think that should be written. What record-breaking series did Lorimar produce that aired in the first in the spring of 78?
Record-breaking?
Record-breaking series did Lorimar... the production company. This show aired in the spring of 78.
Dallas.
Correct.
Yay!
Nice.
Kids and Games is your next category. What Western hero role did Guy Williams win because he was the only applicant who knew how to fence?
What Western hero role?
Yeah. Did Guy Williams win because the only applicant who knew how to fence?
Fencing,
Zorro.
You
say.
Correct.
Yeah.
2 questions left. Get 1 and you get your points. Stars. What band rap group performed Band in the USA on the 1990 MTV Music Awards?
Oh, shit. 2 Live Crew.
You are correct. And there are your points. So that changes things. Tara, update the scores, please.
It sure does. Now, Adam still has 4 points. I still have 8 points. Sarah is breathing down my neck with 7.
Woo. All right. Well done. Round 2 is...
Thanks, 2 Life Crew.
Is animated shows. The TV shows were animated, not necessarily the source, but you'll find those out as we go along. Only 2 questions for each of you in this short round, starting again with Adam. The movie Aladdin, the actor Robin Williams. That's my Robin Williams impression.
There was an Aladdin TV show?
There was.
Can I have the hint, please?
All right. Your hint is...
I know who the character is.
The character is the genie. The show this person is most well known for? The Simpsons.
Oh, is it Hank Azaria?
Decent guess. It is not. It is Dan Castellaneta, the voice of Homer. It's also the genie. Sarah D. Bunting, your movie, Toy Story, the movie actor, Tim Allen,
Okay, so that's going to be Buzz, but I just don't know who might have replaced him, so I'll need the hint, please.
All right, the character is Buzz Lightyear. Your non-union Mexican equivalents TV show is Rules of Engagement. Now, I will add, that is the one they were most involved in, but I'm going to say not the one they're most well known for.
Oh, God. I don't remember this actor's name. I just want to say Putty. Mm. It's David something. Mm. Yeah, I don't know. Sorry.
It's a quarter point.
Yeah, you are on the right track. Patrick Warburton.
Oh. Yeah, he totally is TV's Woody, or TV's Buzz. That's excellent casting.
All right, Tara, here is your first animated question. Osmosis Jones, Chris Rock.
Phil Lamar.
What?
Whoa. Wow.
I'm going to give you two Dave points for that one, too, Tara. That's correct. That show was Futurama, if you needed a hint. All right, back to Adam. Your movie is the Godzilla 1998 film with Matthew Broderick. So the TV show is animated. Yes. Based on the movie.
I'm going to take the hint on this.
All right. We're looking for Nick Talopoulos is the character's name. And your non-union Mexican equivalent TV show is Beverly Hills 90210.
Mm. Oh, boy. Boy.
Got a few to choose from.
Pantsed in front of the two foremost experts. Okay, well, it's got to be either Jason Priestley, Luke Perry, or the third guy. Or the fourth guy, the rapper. Well, I can't remember their names, so I'm going to go with Matthew Broderick. Jason Priestley's got a Matthew Broderick vibe. It's got to be Jason Priestley.
Any guesses from our, again, with this host?
No. I'm going to say Ian Ziering just because I know he did voice.
I think
voice
it's Ian, too.
You betcha. You are correct. You are correct for no points. Sarah Deep Bunting.
Yes.
Ghostbusters, and we have two possible answers, so you know. The actor, Bill Murray.
Okay, so that's Peter Venkman. I'm trying to think who his, well, actually his usual non-union Mexican equivalent is his brother, Bri Doyle Murray, so that's what I'm going to guess because it's free.
That is a very good guess. Incorrect. Two possible answers, so here are your two clues. You were correct, Peter Venkman. Your two shows are Rhoda or Full House.
Rhoda or Full House?
Correct. You're going to have more luck with Full House, is my guess.
Dave Coulier?
You are correct. I think the other one is also the voice of Garfield, Lorenzo Music.
Yeah, Lorenzo Music, right?
Yeah. That was from
just
the real
sidebar, since we're bringing up the Murrays, there's a scene in Lodge 49 with Brian Doyle Murray and Joel Murray, both.
Oh,
a
Joel!
Rare double Murray sighting.
Is Joel the Mad Men one?
Yes.
Okay.
All right, Tara, here's our last question of our animated block. For you, the movie Captain Underpants, your actor, Ed Helms.
Really surprised Ed Helms was too busy to reprise this role for the TV show,
seriously.
Frankly. Nate Cordry.
Love that guess.
All right. Your character is Captain Underpants / Mr. Krupp.
Okay.
Your TV show clue, Ben and Kate. Remember Ben and Kate?
Yes. Is it Nat Faxon?
It is Nat Faxon. I thought you were going to get it right when you started with Nat.
Oh.
I almost buzzed you correctly there. That is good for 1 point, and we're back to a score break.
All right. I now have 11 points. Sarah has 8 points. Adam has 4 points.
All right, Adam. It's time. Your opportunity to get 4 points. You know the deal. Here we go. Classics. What was the occupation of Gomez Adams of the Adams family?
Gomez Adams of the Adams family. I want to say he was a mortician.
Seems like he should be something like that. Correct answer? Yeah. Lawyer. He was a lawyer.
Of course.
Yeah. Sitcoms. What was the secret identity of Police Commissioner Gordon's daughter on Batman?
Oh, her secret identity. Wait, do you mean she was Batgirl? Is that her secret identity?
Adam Sternberg getting well and deep into his own head on that answer. Drama.
I just was confused if you meant what her actual name was as opposed to her. I guess it was a secret that she was Batgirl. Anyway, I'll take it.
Do you want to talk about this some more?
You got it.
All right, drama.
No, let's move on. Let's have...
What was the real name of police? No. What shows Pistol Packin' Mamas included Lorette Spang, Janet Louise Johnson, Julie Craig, and Carlene Watkins?
Wow.
Pistol Packin' Mamas.
Drama.
Drama.
I'm going to say
drama. This might also go into the comedy, probably more comedy.
Oh, okay.
Pistol Packin' Mamas on a, and it's a drama comedy.
Yeah.
I don't know. Lorette Spang. Bonanza.
No, BJ and the Bear.
Okay.
I don't know why that's under drama. But, all right. Kids and games. What Quizmaster's career was damaged by the $64,000 question scandal? What was the Quizmaster on $64,000 question?
Bert Blaine.
Hal March. All right, you need these two, Adam. Put your big brain cap on for stars.
All right.
I believe in you, Adam.
What Watergate crook played Captain Real Estate on Miami Vice?
What Watergate crook played Captain Real Estate? It was probably G. Gordon Liddy.
It was definitely G. Gordon Liddy.
Yes!
All right. Your last question is wild card. Get this right, 4 points. Which had higher ratings in the 1977-78 season? Saturday Night Live or The Tonight Show? You got about a 50-50 chance.
It is a 50-50. 1977, higher ratings. It's got to be The Tonight Show.
Tonight Show is your answer, and you are incorrect.
That is.
Oh, no.
Come on.
Damn.
Boo.
All right, but here's your chance to get some points. Back to the game. These are all comedies or dramedies. You may quibble with some of them, but we got to put them somewhere.
Sure.
Adam Sternberg. Private Benjamin Goldie Hawn.
Eileen Brennan was in the movie. There was a TV show with a Goldie Hawn-esque character. I get a free guess, right?
Sure do.
Yep.
And then I can take the clue. If I'm going to take the clue, I might as well just guess anyway.
Yep.
All right. So I will just guess that it was Suzanne Summers, and then I'll take the clue.
Okay, that is incorrect. The character is Judy Benjamin. The TV show that she is most well known for outside of Private Benjamin, Good Time Girls, which is going to be very helpful. I'm going to give you additional clue because I like you, Adam. She was in Aeroplane.
Aeroplane, the movie?
Yep.
Okay. I don't remember the names. I gotta go with Sandra Bullock on this one.
That's Lorna Patterson was the answer. She was the one of the stewardesses that sings the song and unplugs the IV.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's her. All right, back to Sarah D. Bunting. The movie Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. The actor, Rick Moranis.
The very disrespectful pronunciation of
Rick
his name.
Moranis? Sorry. Sorry,
it's
Richard.
It's Moranis. That guy who plays Richard Code, Rob Benedict.
All right, the character's name, Wayne Szalinski.
Okay.
The show he is most known for, or one of the shows he's most known for, Bosom Buddies.
Oh, Scolari, Peter Scolari.
That is correct. Nice. One. All right, back to Tara.
Bosom Buddies.
Yes.
The movie is MASH. The actor is Donald Sutherland.
Fuck, who was he in the movie? Oh, no.
Well, you got a free stab at it.
That Mike Farrell.
Oh, wow. That shit. Mike Farrell really boils
he
my
really
potatoes.
He really boils my potatoes. That's how I got to say the Simpsons quote.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. The character is Hawkeye Pierce. The other show he's known for, The West Wing.
Sure, Alan Alda.
Alan Alda, the other one, yeah. Back to Adam. Your movie is Clueless. Your movie actor, Alicia Silverstone. This is a tough one.
Clueless TV show, Alicia Silverstone. Who would be Alicia Silverstone on TV? Oh, I bet it is that Canadian actress, Elisa Cuthbert.
Great guess.
Can I have
a character,
clue?
Cher Horowitz. And the TV show this person was involved in, Fargo Season 1.
Hmm.
Not a household name. Not a household name. You know it or you don't, I think, on this one.
I'm going to go with the latter. It's who was in Fargo? It was no, she was in Season 2. Old, what's her name? Juliette Lewis.
Anybody want to take a stab at this one?
Tolman?
I feel like I can picture her, but I don't know her name either.
Rachel Blackard.
Blanchard. Yeah. Blanchard.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's in the first episode.
Also
of,
Canadian. All right.
Sorry, my apologies. My answer is missing a couple letters then. Sarah D. Bunting. The movie, Down and Out in Beverly Hills. The actor, Richard Dreyfuss. Played on TV by who?
Oh, gosh. This seems like another Scolari, but I don't think we have any repeats. Down and Out in Beverly Hills. Who would play this guy?
There are no repeats.
Alan Arkin.
That's a decent guess. All right. The character, Dave Whiteman. That's with an E. The show this person is most known for, Chicago Hope.
It's really tempting to say Adam Arkin, but I'm not going to. I'm going to say Mandy Patinkin.
Nice.
Incorrect. Hector Elizondo.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Huh. Okay.
All right, Tara.
Yep.
Now follow this through when I say it's comedy. So, you know, don't get mad at me, everybody. The movie, right. Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Sure.
Ellen Burstyn.
Mm-hmm. Linda Lavin.
Linda Lavin of Alice the TV show is correct.
There you go.
Adam Sternberg. The movie Parenthood. The actor Steve Martin. Now I'm going to give you a hint. The 2010 Parenthood is not based, is not the same characters. We're looking about, there's a 1990 Parenthood TV show that we're concerned with. So once again, the movie is Parenthood. The actor is Steve Martin. The TV actor from 1990.
Can you give, Steve Martin, who would play him on TV? I don't know. May I have the clue, please?
All right. Gil Buckman is the character. TV show this person is well known for. Saint Elsewhere.
Steve Martin. Saint Elsewhere. Wait, let me just say Hector. Oh, wait, is it Ed Begley Jr.?
It is. Yep. Ed Begley Jr. 1 point. Nice.
Really? You're not a Steve Martin-y energy from that guy, but
no.
They went their own way.
10 Things I Hate About You. Heath Ledger.
You know, I never saw that movie. Not that it would have helped me. Honestly. Adam Scott.
Patrick Verona is the character's name. All right. Here is a good hint, but whether you can trace it back to the actor. Star Trek Discovery Season 2.
I'm going to say she cannot.
No.
I couldn't. And I like Star Trek.
That is not helpful. No. So
I'm going to give you a bonus hint, Sarah. I saw him at our Ralph's one time in L.A.
Wow.
So still not Robert Guillaume. Okay. Robert Guillaume.
Incorrect. Tara, do you know the actor name?
Yeah, it's Ethan Peck, right?
Ethan Peck.
I have never heard of such a thing.
He's the new Spock on Discovery. He's Gregory Peck's like grandson, I think.
Okay. Good for him.
All right, Tara. The movie Party Girl, the actor Parker Posey.
God, I don't know. Margaret Cho.
All right. The character is Mary.
Yeah.
The show this person is probably most well known for on TV, Arrested Development.
Portia de Rossi? Shit.
We're looking for Christine Taylor. Christine Taylor.
Oh, okay, sure.
All right, everybody's last question coming at you. Adam Sternberg, the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Your actor, second appearance by Jennifer Grey.
Oh, man, I thought you were going to say Matthew Broderick.
Nope.
Gotcha. It's a TV show, Ferris Bueller, Jennifer Grey. I'm going to say Alicia Silverstone.
Incorrect. We're looking for Jeannie Bueller. And this person is most well known for a little TV show called Friends.
Oh, you know what? I actually read about this in the oral history of Friends, in that weird Warren Littlefield oral history book about all the shows that the people did before they were cast on Friends. I believe the answer is Ms. Jennifer Aniston.
You are correct for a point.
Hey!
Well done. Sarah D. Bunting.
Sarah. There you go.
Sorry.
Thank you.
TV show. The movie, Gidget. The actor, Sandra Dee. Looking for the TV show actor who played the same character.
I didn't even know it was a movie.
Me neither. Sally Field.
Sally Fields is good for two. And our last question of the game for Tara. The movie is Gung Ho, which I'm going to guess ages terribly, but let's just...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's not going to work.
Starring Michael Keaton.
Okay. Who is TV's Michael Keaton back in the day? Jeff Conaway.
Incorrect. Oh. Your clue... This character, Hunt Stevenson, because, yeah, sure, why not?
Uh-huh.
And the show is a little show called Quantum Leap.
Oh, Scott Bakula.
Yes, Scott Bakula is correct for 1 point. All right, that is regulation, Tara. Let's hear our final scores.
Very competitive game. Adam finished with 6. Sarah had 11. I finished with 15.
All right. Yay! So Tara takes the day. Let's reuse our tiebreaker for a steel meal for future use. I will give you another clue. This is still a comedy category. I will give you the movie and the actor. You tell me the TV actor. First person to shout it out gets the steel meal. Here we go. Wet Hot American Summer, Bradley Cooper. The character is Ben. The TV show this person is most well known for, Parks and Rec.
Chris Pratt.
Incorrect. Big recasting written into the show, too.
Adam Scott.
Adam Scott is correct. Oh, what Hot American Summer 10 years later.
Hey, buddy.
Went in for a nose job.
Right.
Came out Adam Scott.
That's right.
That'll happen.
Tara. Congratulations.
Tara.
Me.
Tara.
I don't know why. I think you might be in trouble. Distress. Shoot the shotgun 3 times.
Help.
Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We sang the praises, kind of Danny McBride's new HBO series, The Righteous Gemstones, before going around the dial, where we entered Lodge 49, caught up with the boys and years, and went fourth and long with QB1. inducting Caroline's choice of Sherlock's debut episode, A Study in Pink Canon, was Elementary. We clued you into the winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
You have heard the good news.
Sarah D. Bunting.
You can't just roll up in my foyer.
And Adam Sternberg.
Hallelujah.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Where are you going?
I just need to talk about the rent.
I've still got questions.
What now? I'm in shock. Look, I've got a blanket.